I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi everyone, you are back with the Telegraph Rugby podcast ahead of a spicy weekend of fixtures featuring the Calcutta Cup. Wales heading to Dublin and France hosting Italy, not in Paris, but in Lille. I'm Ben Coles, joined as ever by the illustrious Charlie Morgan. Hi Charlie.
That's very kind.
And the captivating Charles Richardson.
Oh my word. Hello.
Hi. Charles, I've chiselled out 5 minutes to start just to talk about your view from the Ealing press box where you were on Sunday. So tell us everything about it.
Really not good. It was a good game and a bit of a thriller in the end. And it was a decent spectacle. And I'm very impressed with what Ealing are building. But they need, I think, more help to improve their infrastructure. I don't think the stadium is quite ready for the Premiership yet. And that's irrespective of my view, which was not amazing. We were on the 22-metre line on the press and we weren't particularly high up and there was a big bar in front of my eyes. They have a very good squad and they really did cause Leicester problems yesterday in the Premiership Rugby Cup semi-final, but I think they just need a bit more help and I think a day like yesterday might be the wake-up call to the RFU and other executives in the country that really they are able to compete on the field because they lost narrowly to one of the Premiership heavyweights, but they need support off it.
To be clear, a metal bar, not a drinks bar in front of you.
Unfortunately.
Shame, because actually that
real shame.
That made your experience more interesting. I was at the other Premiership Rugby Cup semi-final, which was fine. Yeah.
The Zach Mercer show?
Yeah. For about 50 minutes, and he was great, and Exeter's tackling was very much the opposite of great. It was such a weird kind of game. I didn't know how much to take out of it. Like it was a slightly subdued crowd and lots of youngsters and lots of players who are going to be involved for England A this Sunday against Portugal. And in fact, Rob Baxter afterwards said that actually all the players who were actually selected for England A didn't actually play that great. Whereas all the players who were originally in the wider England A squad and got trimmed, whose names we don't know, actually played really well. Mm. So it was a bit of an odd occasion. You got Gloucester Leicester in the Premiership Rugby Cup final on the 15th of March, I believe.
Yeah, the weekend of the final round of Six Nations matches.
So just before, the night before Super Saturday. So, yeah.
And Mercer, his CV's, according to French press, has been doing the rounds with top 14 clubs this morning.
So I saw that, and I'm curious, because he signed quite a long deal, didn't he, to come back to Gloucester, I think we believed. And obviously he's only in the middle of his first season. So if you are, I think I saw Toulon and Montpellier were the interested clubs, you're going to have to pay quite a wedge to get him out of his contract. Yeah, he's certainly, he was very impressive for Gloucester. That's the Premiership Rugby Cup. Our attention turns back towards the Six Nations with haste. So let's talk a bit about Charlie. You've spoken to Ben White, the Scotland scrum half. He's our guest this week. How did you find that?
Well, I felt guilty for not going to a Premiership Cup fixture.
As
start,
you should.
But he was fantastic. I worked it out a lot. The previous time I'd spoken to him was when he was, I think, 18, and he was at the time, probably still is, the youngest player ever to play for Leicester Tigers. So it was sort of, this guy's up and coming, he's going to play for England age groups. And I remember him being quite sort of fairly quiet and fairly understated about what he'd achieved so far, as you'd expect from someone to come through the Tigers Academy, to be honest. But it was great. I think without bigging this interview up too much, I think if you don't know that much about Ben White and you listen to him, you will not help but want him to do well for the rest of his career. He was really, really honest and open, but also just really exuded a kind of satisfaction about where he is at the minute, while knowing that he's got a hell of a long way to go, a lot more that he wants to achieve in his career. And the fact that he said a few times, "I'm not taking this for granted. I'm absolutely loving this opportunity I've got in Test rugby and loving being part of this Scotland environment, which seems really healthy, really energetic." We spoke a little bit about them not getting over the line to go 2-from-2 and setting up the Calcutta Cup that way. But yeah, he's scored in his first two games against England and looking to go 3-from-3.
I was going to say, it goes without saying, he's been playing very, very well for Scotland, and he's going to be a key figure Saturday's game at Murrayfield. Let's not waste any more time. Let's get into it. So speaking about Ben White, he's obviously one scrum half involved, but one scrum half won't be involved, Charles, and they call that a segue, is Alex Mitchell. What's happened? Why isn't Alex Mitchell going to be playing?
Yeah, limped off the open training session with a knee injury on Friday in front of, was it 10,000?
It was, yeah.
Let's were there?
Shall we bring this up? Yes. I was at this open training session.
I didn't necessarily want to go down it.
And but as a journalist, you live in fear of missing the line. And I was in my defence, I was allowed to watch for 20 minutes. And I don't think it's happened then, but it was the other side of the pitch if it did happen. I missed it. And when we put up the piece from the open training session, we had a couple of very eagle-eyed readers who were there who said, "I hope Alex Mitchell's okay." And I panicked and thought, oh, well.
It's a real shame that we didn't have a live feed to you and we could have had our very own Cammy.
I
thought we were bringing a sub on, Jeff.
That's what it was like at Witten's train station where I was filing. Where I'd filed and then saw the, apparently tackled from, we've got a bit more info on it this morning, tackled from behind presumably after making a break during the conditioned games that they were playing, isn't as bad as worst case scenario, a grade 2 strain of his ACL rather than a pop or a tear. So he'll be back for Saints, end of season for Saints, minimum layoff 6 weeks, maximum 12 weeks. But that's obviously going to come.
So his tournament's done?
His tournament's done is the top line, yeah.
That's a real shame, given how, you know, the potential for him to sort of bed in with that side a bit more. Apologies to him as well, because it's the media curse, because we spoke to him on Wednesday about how well things were going and then inevitably picked up a real injury. So what does that mean, Charles, in terms of selection if Mitchell's out? Who are we going to see? Who's going to start at Murrayfield?
I mean, it has to be Danny Kerr, doesn't it? Just because he's been involved in around the match day 23 under Steve Borthwick just for so long now, since last year, and obviously he played that finishing role in the World Cup and has been at the start of the Six Nations. So I would be very, very surprised if Borthwick threw caution to the wind and picked Ben Spencer to start. You'd expect Spencer to be on the bench, but stranger things have happened. You know, he's not featured yet. It seems like it's going to be a straight shootout between Harry Randall of Bristol and Ben Spencer of Bath for that bench spot. Ben Spencer is, we've always said, has been a sort of archetypal Borthwick number 9, and I found his omission last year quite bizarre. Then he was brought back in for this Six Nations, and who knows? I mean, he does play a Borthwick style of rugby. His skills, his fundamental skills, are very good. He's got a very good kicking game. He could come into the picture to start at Murrayfield, but I'd be very, very surprised.
So just to kind of touch back on that, put me in cold sweats and touch back on that open training session. Mitchell and Kerr were doing a lot of the kind of the structure stuff with nines around, sort of around the breakdown. So it seemed like there was almost daylight between those two and Spencer as far as pecking order. And Spencer has been travelling to the games as a travelling reserve, because obviously you'd want three without the kind of constraints that England have with Premiership, with releasing players for the Premiership action at the minute. You'd need a third scrum half just in case the worst happens. So Spencer's been doing that. I wonder whether if this had happened before the Italy game, Spencer would be starting. It's just that we've had this time, and you just think going to Murrayfield for a Calcutta Cup game that that experience of Kerr. We know both how much Borthwick values experience. But then at the same time, Kerr is seemingly so much better suited to this finishing, inverted commas, role. And if you watch him when he's come on in those games, he's been really proactive in defence. He's been pushing out in that 13 channel, and maybe it's that he might have been better suited to doing that from the start against Scotland anyway. So we'll see. It's going to be really interesting. But, you know, you'd hope that a coach would say, look, if a player is involved in our squad, then we believe them good enough to start. That would be the argument for Spencer jumping the pecking order, as actually Alex Mitchell did during the World Cup, right? Went from fourth choice to first choice.
Yeah. And when Borthwick recalled Kerr, he did also mention about how much his sort of tactical kicking he thought had improved, and his sort of control and game management from the base alongside Marcus Smith. I think he cited Harlequins at Welford Road at the end of last season as a good example of that. I think they won. Leicester had already qualified for the playoffs, and Harlequins won at Welford Road. And I think he cited that game as just them two just controlling things really nicely. So I don't think there'll be too many worries from Borthwick's camp about that. But I do agree that, you know, I think if this had happened pre-Italy, then Spencer might have been given the reins with Kerr continuing in that role off the bench. But now there's a bit of a spanner in the works.
Yeah, there's better injury news in other positions, because England have Luke Cowan-Dickie back in the fold, but more interestingly, and sound the klaxon, it's midfield selection debate time.
I don't believe it.
You've got both Manu Tuilagi and Ollie Lawrence back and available. Ollie Lawrence was quite interesting, because when he was listed in the squad for last week's fallow week training sessions, he was listed as a rehabbing player, but Charlie, on Friday, it sounds like he was tearing in and mixing it up as much as everybody, so this isn't a shock that he's available, but it's a wondrous rehabilitation process.
Did you see that bit?
I was going to say, at least one thing that I saw was Ollie Lawrence looking very involved and very mobile. More mobile, it has to be said, than Manu Tuilagi. Maybe that's to be expected, because Manu Tuilagi hasn't played since around Christmas was when...
Just to clarify, so Tuilagi was a groin.
Around,
Lawrence was a hip?
A hip issue, I think. Okay. And that happened in Toulouse, right? So that was just on the verge of the Six Nations, and it was kind of cruel timing on that front. I think for me, I've seen it mooted that those two could start together. I'd be very, very surprised if that happened, if only just because they're both recent returnees from injury, and also you'd have to really think about who is at fullback. You probably need to get more distribution into your back line somewhere. I think Henry Slade has been in a quite understated way, quite important to how England have defended, translating that sort of Exeter aggressive system and being really proactive with his line speed there. He's also come into first receiver quite a lot from strike moves, and I think that's significant too. I could see Henry Slade has played with both of them a fair bit, actually, but he's shown quite nice chemistry with both of them. I think that Slade-Lawrence partnership, that would be what I'd predict.
And then Manu as bench option potentially to break the game up. It's interesting, isn't it, how they kind of, who they're going to go for. Charles, which way are you leaning if you were bringing one of the two? But I mean, and also, I mean, got to mention Fraser Dingwall. Like, you know, are we just assuming that's him out the team and not in the mix because they're back?
Yeah, I think this could spell the end of Dingwall. I'd bring Lawrence back, I think.
For now.
yeah. Not forever, hopefully. And that's to take nothing away from him in those first two games, where he was nothing but sort of dependable and solid, by that one sort of quite glaring missed tackle at the end of the Italy game. But I think they do need more oomph. And I think that Lawrence is the man to provide that. But it's going to be strange. I wouldn't like Lawrence necessarily playing 12, but I don't think it really matters so much. Maybe Lawrence could play 12 defensively, keep Slade at 13 where he's been running that blitz, and then in attack, I mean, they can just switch around, really. It doesn't really matter. They don't sort of... Numbers on the backs in the midfield doesn't make as much difference anymore. But yeah, to bring back both Lawrence and Tuilagi, would presumably have to have Furbank at 15, which would therefore be four changes to the back line with Mitchell.
A mad stat from Kevin Miller at Top of the Moon GW on Twitter, X, now it's known as. Manu Tuilagi has never played against Scotland at Murrayfield.
That's mad. I mean, obviously I know he's been, you know, he's had his injuries and his time away from the side, but yeah, that is quite extraordinary that he hasn't He's never done that before. Faced him at Twickenham loads, obviously. In terms of anything
once.
Else?
Oh, yeah, go on. He's faced them once at Twickenham.
Once at Twickenham.
Yeah. Oh, so he's ever played them once?
No, he played against them in the 2011 World Cup.
Oh, okay.
This is all in one tweet from Kevin Miller.
Okay, so he's played them twice, that's it.
What a niche selection of matches. So the 2011 World Cup and once at Twickenham. Anything else on the open training session that you kind of you enjoyed or learned?
I thought it was really good do. I thought they put the RFU deserve a lot of credit for doing that, and I think importantly they're doing another one in York on the next fellow weekend. If they're not going to move games around, I think that's quite important because there I saw fans from Basingstoke, from Newcastle at this one at Twickenham. I mean, going by what they were wearing, but it was so that was really good. I think really important, tangible way of engaging supporters. Really, I think it's just really beneficial for us, isn't it, to see what the work that goes into those training sessions. And I wrote that your trainee teachers will moan and groan about lesson planning and all that they have to do, especially while they're kind of learning that profession. Planning is absolutely key for coaches, and they put in so much time to that. And that was really obvious in everything, not only just because of how everything is laid out before you see this training session, but also because of how quickly things move, how quickly players move in and move out of the designated teams. What was really obvious was how much time they're still hammering this blitz defence. They really want to get this.
I was going to say, there were a lot of photos of Felix Jones kind of addressing huddles and stuff. Was that what you saw?
They want to get that nailed down clearly. Just everything from how the outside backs came away to just run to run shuttles, which were kind of instigated by Felix Jones passing a ball. Obviously, the obvious aim was there just to get in Scotland's faces and fill that 13 channel. I would expect that to happen a lot at Murrayfield. And then also when they were playing the collective games, they were really pressing home nine speed. Carl Dixon was refereeing. There were a couple of interceptions that I saw. Chanda Cunningham South picked off Finn Smith, and then Max Ajomo got one later on. So they're really, really pushing players to get off the line. That was just really, really obvious from what we were able to see.
I can't remember if we said it internally. Do you wonder, question for both of you, Charles, maybe you first, do you wonder if they're just looking at this Six Nations and thinking, let's sort the defence in this tournament, and then the attack will come, I don't know, summer tour or the autumn. Is in very much taking a long-term view. Now, that might be giving them too much credit from what we've seen in attack. But you know, it is the start of a new cycle. I just wondered if maybe the priority is just that defence for now and everything else is based on what we've seen from training sessions and you know, from last Friday as well.
Perhaps, certainly. I mean, there has definitely been a bit of a reset, hasn't there? And certainly patience is going to be key. All I would say is that has been the message emanating from the England camp since Steve Borthwick took over, was that, you know, the attack's going to take time to bed in. It's going to take time to bed in. It's going to take time to bed in. Well, at some point, it's going to need to bed in. And they're going to New Zealand this summer, where they're going to have to play some rugby. And it could do with clicking maybe before then, especially given that they've got Ireland and France back to back in the Six Nations. You know, that they're two good, real tough tests to come out and show what they've been developing and what the sort of what flourishes and sort of cherries on the cake they've been adding, and also just on the defence. I mean, are we going to have to talk about the sort of pack a little bit? George Martin, do we feel he's going to come in with his sort of defensive strengths? I mean, I can see him being parachuted straight in, but then who goes? You decide.
Well does Roots, a bit like the talk about Dingwall in midfield, is Roots actually the unfortunate person who, despite not doing an awful lot wrong, who's played the match against Italy, suddenly misses out because other players are available? I mean, like you say, the idea of Chess and Martin Itoje, or Itoje, Chess and Martin, depending how you want to do it, 4-6, seems quite appealing.
Mm. Would you move Roots to 7?
No, I wouldn't. For a piece this week, I've looked at...
Or Roots to 8 and L to 7?
Maybe. For a piece this week, I've looked at... So Scotland played South Africa at the World Cup, didn't they? With Felix Jones part of South Africa's coaching team, they restricted Scotland to 3 points, which I think Finn Russell, in something like 240 starts in his professional career, is only 3 times that he's been restricted to that few points, which I found remarkable. Then watching that game back, South Africa got a little bit lucky. The Jesse Creel high shot on Jack Dempsey, nothing came of that. But that was just such a good, sharp, strategic performance. They targeted line speed at 10 and then at 13. And then what that did was funnel players back towards towards kind of in and around the ruck, the interior of the ruck, where they've obviously got those big men. I think that England will take a lot from that performance. And I think their how they set up 4-6 will be a big part of that. They could go with Chesson Martin Itoje in whatever order at 4-6. What they have with Roots is a guy who can jump in the line out. So they can, it's not like, you know, it's not like they are, it's not like they have to either go with a quicker back rower and then a hybrid. So Roots is that in between. So they could still kind of implement that sort of game plan. But I think with those three kind of big guys there at lock, sort of lock hybrids, I think that gives them quite a lot.
This probably contradicts the idea of having three great jumpers or four great jumpers, but do we expect them to basically nick France's kicking game strategy from Murrayfield and kick everything long and keep everything on the field, because to negate Scotland's counter-attacking threats? Because it worked well for France, and Scotland didn't seem to have much of an answer.
Can rugby as a concept cope with another 80 minutes of that?
I'm not saying I want it, but I can see how it would be incredibly effective.
It's going to be a ton of kicking. Andrew Brace refereeing. I would say that Scotland kicking a lot as well.
Most in the championship, haven't they?
Top three. Finn Russell's top four kicking meters by absolutely miles. Number three is Ben White. So they're kicking a lot through those guys. Their Ben White try that they scored against France came from a recovered box kick. So I think Scotland are going to kick a lot to compete and then play off the back of that, maybe. And maybe that nullifies how England set up and impart pressure in defence. Either way, there's going to be a lot of kicking, man.
Yeah. You've sold me on kicking. I feel like Scotland are very deservedly favourites for this, not just based on recent matches, but also their first 50 minutes against Wales and France. I think have been very good, very promising. I don't think either of you are going to argue that Scotland are favourites.
No, I wouldn't. I'd probably go 50-50, in fairness. Mm. No, I think 50-50. I think Scotland have looked fallible, and England are coming in off the back of two wins, and we know in tight matches in the Six Nations that momentum does play a part, and the ability to close out matches and just to have those wins in your back can do a lot for confidence. And I think obviously then Scotland have the home advantage and the fact that England's record against them over the past however many years, 7 or 8 years, has been pretty average, worse than average. So I would go 50-50, but that's even better. I think that's even better. I think it's really, really tantalisingly poised this weekend.
Yeah, I think it's so close. With another thing I'd throw in there, I'd first of all start by saying how well balanced Scotland are and settled now. And we've spoken in the past few weeks, haven't we, about how they've had quite a nice transition between World Cup cycles, given the age profile of their squad. They are equipped to go from strength to strength. The factor that Steve Borthwick has a couple of weeks lead in to this game, we know how much he likes kind of zeroing on an opponent, and all we hear about Felix Jones is that he's fantastic at that, really getting into the nitty gritty and analysing opponents and figuring out game plans. That makes me think it's going to be closer from the point of having Scotland favourites. So yeah. I think it would be the biggest win of Borthwick's tenure, right? Maybe if you take out that first Argentina game in the World Cup, given
with the 14,
but yeah, only maybe pre-game. I think England are going to have to be very, very good, but I think they have the coaching team to really put in a game plan that will get them close. Having said that, I still would back Scotland just to nick it, I think.
I think also what we have to remember is we've blown a lot of wind into Scotland's sails, and rightly so. You know, they've got this golden generation, and yet a loss at Murrayfield on Saturday and they could be looking at fourth. I mean, realistically, it will be a fourth place. It could be better than fourth. But so for all of the success that they've had in terms of developing and improving with this group of players and you know, really rattling the cages of some of the best teams in the world, a loss on Saturday, the pressure is on them, because a loss on Saturday and they could be looking at a fourth place finish.
Yeah. Yeah, I would like to see an exceptionally annoyed Scotland based on the aftermath of the France game come out and actually deliver a bit of a statement and kind of blow England away as much as they can and then cling on, because that's the problem. We've seen it in patches. Against France, they didn't score enough points. Against Wales, they let them back in. Maybe this is the time, third time around, where actually they get the job done. With England, if they win this and they're 3 out of 3, are we verging on a Wales 2021 expletive house slam, which didn't quite come off, but where they just seem to, you know, by hook or by crook, end up in title contention and then winning the lot. I mean,
you can't win the lottery if you don't buy a ticket, is all I would say. You know,
I've been thinking about that, that campaign for Wales in relation to how
don't say the word
they've muddled through those first two games, and that's what people keep saying, right? Isn't it? Those first 2 weeks that can be horrible, can be really, really ugly. But if you're still in the mix for it, and if you get through with wins, then you can expand from there. England are going to have to find another level, because these next three games, Scotland, Ireland, France, are going to go up another level. They're still a team that are without the leadership of Owen Farrell and Courtney Laws, and we're talking about that less. But that is still, you know, does that rear its head and become more of an issue the bigger the game? We'll see.
Mm. So Brian Moore wrote that he'd bring back the elder statesman.
Yes.
This morning on the Telegraph website. What do we think about props? I think I'd probably start Genge and Cole together.
Potentially I'd like maybe a start for Genge. I'm trying to think back to how Scotland scrum has fared. They had that horror scrum on the edge of half time where Cyril Bye got on top of Ferguson and all Scotland's momentum was sucked away because they didn't kick points and they wanted more. So there's a chance there that. Do you start with your strongest scrummages first? I don't know, Charlie.
That's difficult, isn't it? I think, do we overstate just the lack of mobility that Marla and Cole have? Maybe Marla. I think Marla could still get around the pitch.
Yeah.
I just keep thinking about the end of the game at Twickenham last year when the kind of the kicking battle disintegrated, didn't it? Because England started kicking too long. They were looking a bit weary and Scotland started picking them off in counter and Cole looked really vulnerable in that game. I think the weather is meant to be a little bit drizzly, so potentially making it more difficult to go from deeper. So maybe that plays into it as well. I'm really not sure. England are going to have to not bleed scrum penalties, and if they're even slightly off there, Scotland have improved so much that they, with Schumann and Ferguson, that they're going to be able to cause problems there. So that's certainly a consideration they'll have to take on board.
It's going to be fun. It's going to be tight. Very much looking forward to it. And we've got a bit of perspective from the Scottish camp right now as Charlie spoke to Ben White.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Telegraph Rugby Podcast. Thanks so much for your time.
No, thank you for having me.
Now, I used to feel a bit sorry for players who were kind of shuttling back and forth from overseas clubs to Six Nations camps, but
you put on a very nice coastal snap on your Instagram story of what Toulon looked like, and I didn't feel particularly sorry for you. It's like you're enjoying life down there.
No, it definitely makes it a little bit easier. I mean, one thing that you don't see is the added travel, which is tedious. But once you get here, no, obviously it's nice to be here, and obviously being where we are in the world, it does make it a little bit easier when you know your post training recoveries in the sea. So it's nice.
You take me back to your first contact with Gregor, please. So that would have been head of the Six Nations a couple of years ago. I think 3 years. 3 years prior to that, you'd played for England in the Barbarians fixture with guys who are your Marcus Smith, Alex Mitchell, Joe Marchant. But then all of a sudden you're in the Scotland mix. Can you tell me about how that's come about?
Yeah, so it was in my first year at London Irish. It was actually when the autumns were on. I remember because I watched Scotland, I think it might have been Scotland, South Africa, that weekend. I just like watching rugby. I watch most matches. I think people who know me probably have a bit of a nose like that. But no, I was just watching the matches and stuff. And I got a message from a guy called Gav Vaughan, who's like the head analyst and things in Scotland. And he messaged and said that they were watching me and that they were interested in things. And then that, you know, if things pursue, sort of Gregor would want to have a call and things, which was obviously, you know, really exciting for me, for an international coach to say that they're interested in speaking to you. Obviously, you know, it's really cool. So, and then after that, I had a call with Gregor. You know, he spoke a little bit about himself and the team and what his vision was. And then also just around, you know, myself, how he thought I was playing, what he thought I did well, what he thought I could do better. I think I just got on. I just liked the way that he spoke and the way that he talked about the game was really good to me. And then for the next, you know, couple of weeks, he'd send me clips from games. He'd send me things that I'd done well, things that he'd want me to work on, and just would, you know, text me on WhatsApp with clips of my games and stuff. And I was like, wow, this is brilliant. Like, he's, you know, obviously clearly watching every minute of my match, and he sent me clips. And like, these three phases were good, but here you waited at this rock. Why did you wait there? What are you thinking? What are you seeing? You know, and just actually the level of coaching in terms of developing me as an individual was brilliant. And that was something that, you know, I was probably taking a bit aback, but I was like, oh my God, I need to be really good at every phase here. He's watching like every pass, every kick, every movement off the ball. So, and that was, sort of where the contact started. And then after a couple of weeks of that, before the squad announcement, he called me one evening and said that if I wanted to, I would be in the Six Nations squad. And I didn't even bat an eyelid. I was just like, yeah, I'm in 100%. I'll be there. And it was amazing, to be honest.
The certainly the Scotland setup has got a really good reputation for doing their due diligence on players, as you've just mentioned there. As far as your heritage, they knew that you qualified clearly as well, right?
Yeah, so when I was 15, 16, I actually did the Scottish Exiles programs, maybe 14, 15, 16. So there was a guy called Rob Riley, who's head of the Scottish Exiles program. And I was a part of that from young age, you know, when I wasn't, this was before I was sort of in, so at 16 in, at the time at Leicester's Academy, you'd go full time and move to Leicester. And then you were, for your basically low sixth and upper sixth or college, you'd move to Leicester. And for me, before that, you know, my dad used to take me up to Sheffield to Mount St. Mary's, I think it was. And I used to go and do camps up there, and it was brilliant. That was like my first sort of experience of like a camp as such. You know, you go for 3 nights up in Mount St. Mary's, you'd go train, eat, sleep together as a, you know, a little kind of group, and it was great and I loved it. And that's probably where, I guess, obviously where, you know, I always knew that I could play from Scotland through my grandparents and stuff. And it was always something that I had in my head that I'd like to do one day. And so I guess they always knew that I had Scottish heritage. And like you say, they obviously have people whose job it is to, you know, find out, you know, your Scottish heritage stuff all over the world and things. And yeah, you know, it's brilliant to be a part of.
Magic. After, how would you assess two rounds of the Six Nations? For you guys, it's been light and shade, right? You've been involved in two really, really tight ones, and right side of one, wrong side of the other. How do you look at it?
Yeah, no, like you say, I think we had 50 minutes against Wales that were pretty much perfect. Going 27-0 up in a test match is not something that happens very often. And I think the way that we've played has been slightly different. I think feel like we've kicked a little bit more than we used to do. We used to just play a lot and play a lot and play a lot, and I think sometimes that put us under pressure. So I guess maybe something that Gregor, for, since the World Cup's brought in, is just getting that control, you know, around the pitch, but also playing our game. Like we have some brilliant athletes, you know, Duhans, Carl Staines, Carl Rose, like the works, you know, Harry Patson played brilliant at the weekend, and all of these people that have come on, you know, they're brilliant athletes. We have to get them more. We have to let them do their thing. So like, it's just striking the balance of when we play and when we're sort of controlling the game. And I think, at times we got it right, and at times we've got it wrong. But like, you know, in every test match, there's going to be moments where the opposition are on top of you, and you have to sort of weather that storm before you can go again. And you know, in the France game, I actually thought we responded really well from that Wales game. We spoke a lot about just when we lost control of the match, how we regain as a team, how we sort of fix the problems on the pitch, and going into, and obviously one of the biggest things without, with this blaringly obvious, was the fact we have, I think it was 16 penalties on the spin in a test match, which, you know, we were lucky to actually get a win there with that sort of record. So, because not many teams win conceding that many penalties. So yeah, obviously, and I don't think we gave away many at all against France. So, you know, from that side of things, I think we improved a lot. And obviously, for most parts of the game against France, we controlled it really well. And we, you know, we kicked to get the ball back. We kicked to get better ball, to create attacking opportunities. And obviously, the try that I scored myself came off the back of that, and coming alive off turnover and things. And, you know, that's what we do best. So, yeah, I think that's probably what I'd say. Obviously, it's difficult to just lose it narrowly at the end, but that's sport.
We're gonna come back to your tries a little bit later on, but if I can just bring you into that moment, your view of it. I was watching back footage before we started chatting, and you are very, very close to it, as you'd expect from a scrum half. What was your view of it at the time, and then also, I guess, since you just said there, that's sport, so it sounds like you've managed to park it and move on. Is there any sense in holding on to the sort of injustice of it, or do you just have to move on to the next week?
Look, you know, it's obviously very, very difficult to sort of just, you know, you can blase just say, yeah, look, let it go. And obviously, you know, you want to win, and you want to go 2-0 in the Six Nations and win your home games. You know, I was very close to the ruck, and when I saw him pick and get over the line, and initially I you know, you saw the foot underneath it, and you're like, oh. and then it moved, and you saw it hit the floor, and you were like, oh, okay. And then I saw, you know, like when Sam got up and he was like, it's a try. Most of the time, players, when we come in, you know, you come together and you're like, was it a try? Or you're like, are we, you know, the player, most players know it within themselves. They might be like, you know, to the fans, they might celebrate or whatever, but then they'll go to it's not a try, quickly. We can get this gone. But, you know, he was pretty adamant that he scored it. And but I guess, you know, after that, once that decision's made, and obviously the formats it took to make the decision and stuff, and, you know, you hear on the audio after the match, you know, it go back and forward, and they say they see the ball on the floor, then they say they don't see the ball on the floor, and there's not conclusive evidence the ball's on the floor. But hey, look, you know, once the referee makes his decision, we have to live with that. You know, as fans, you can be upset and angry and change your opinions, but as players, it's done, it's finished, it's parked. And I think, you know, if anything, it makes you actually, you know, look at the situation of how we could have controlled it better to be better next time when we go for, you know, picking and going. I know I've seen stills of, you know, they look up and the whole field, and you're like, you know, you could have just passed it one more time. And yeah, course, now in hindsight, it's 2020. But I think, again, you know, that's maybe something that we can work on in terms of actually scanning that space or whatever. And but if it's a try, you don't talk about that. So that's just sport sometimes. But obviously, we have to make sure, just especially at test level, every time you get into the 22, every time you're close to try line, you have to come away with points. And in the first half off of scrum as well, you know, we backed ourselves to go for the scrum and to play off it and try and score with an extra number in the backs. And, you know, we didn't come away with points there. So, you know, there's little things within the game that, you know, as halfbacks and as a team, we have to probably control better and to make sure we come away with points.
But I hope you don't mind me saying this. You play as though you have this chip on your shoulder. You are the competitive edge just exudes from you. I spoke to Gus War about this before last year, and he said that it was something he really prided himself on. Effectively, he said, "Look, I'm annoying. I lean into that." Is that something you pride yourself on too? That sheer competitive edge?
Yeah, I think for me, it's more of a balance. I want to be, I compete in every play, in every moment, and I want to win. I want to do everything I can to make sure my team wins, whatever situation that is. You know, I'll give everything to try and get a better outcome for my team, which is the most important thing. And, you know, in terms of, you know, being I think a scrum half, sometimes you are a bit chirpy, whether that's, you know, with your own team, trying to get them fired up and getting them going and giving them clarity and stuff, or it's, you know, you get caught up in a moment and you're getting aggressive with the other team. I don't think necessarily for me it's like I'm not somebody with that exudes, you know, confidence or whatever. I just sort of try and do my job. And I know that if I play with speed and I play with passion and aggression and I work hard off the ball whenever I can, then I'll do my job well. So for me, like, I have to do that. Like, I'm getting to play, you know, in an international match. Why would I not, you know, work hard off the ball? Why would you not try and win every moment? Like, that's my job. That's what I'm here to do. That's how you keep getting picked. So, I guess that competitive edge is something that, you know, I've always had. And the boys laugh at me sometimes in training when I get carried away in a couple of moments. And, you know, but hey, it's all good. And it's just, everyone knows it's just because you want to win. So it's what you need.
What is the mindset like for you personally with England, given it's a side that you've represented even as far as senior level, you've captained them at under 20 level? Do you have to detach yourself from it? Do you lean into that? How does that work for you? How do you approach those fixtures? Because this will be your third, obviously.
I'll be honest, not really. Like, the emotion has to be there for every test match. If, you know, if you walk out there and, you know, you look up at the crowd and the big lights and you're like, oh God, what am I doing here? You're lost at sea as such. So, you know, for me, I guess, you know, playing against England, they're a very good team with brilliant individuals. And, you know, I've played against a lot of their players and with a lot of their players for a long time. So, you know how good they can be. For me, it's just about doing my own prep, being ready for myself. And I think one thing that has actually really helped me over the last sort of couple of years for these matches is with Scotland, there's a guy called Aaron Walsh, who's like a psychologist and stuff. And I work with somebody at London Irish as well. And, you know, these guys have helped me a lot to get to where I am, to be able to find the balance between sort of, you know, they call it the red and the blue and all that stuff and whatever, and just be, you know, having that right balance to be really calm and controlled in these moments, to be on the edge of aggression, but also being clear, because, you know, in my job, I need to think clearly and to you know, to play at speed, you have to be clear in your mind and clear with the game plan. So, you know, that's really helped me. And, you know, they've helped me have a couple of things that, you know, in matches, if I make mistakes or you know, things aren't going right, I can sort of anchor upon and improve my game. So I think when I'm in those big matches, I know that if I've done my prep right, I've done my, you know, all the little things going into the game, then I know I can just go out there and play. And it's even more important, you know, the bigger the match comes.
I just had one last one, Ben, and I hope you don't mind me saying it, at test level over the last 2 years, you've settled into a really clear, really important role with Scotland. What's come across over the last 20 minutes or so while we've been chatting is just how much you're relishing it and enjoying it and really not taking it for granted at all. You're a student of the game who's loving where you are at the minute. But how do you feel now 2 years on as a test player? Maybe how have you developed and how much are you enjoying it?
Oh, I love absolutely, every minute of it. I think you can't take it for granted at all. Like, every time, you walk up to Murrayfield or whatever, you're like, wow, this genuinely could be, the last time or whatever. And it's special to get to play in these matches. And for me, everything you do is to get there. So you have to enjoy it. You have to, try and play with a smile and love it. It's not easy because you get caught up in it and you have that, inner want and desire to win and to play well. And, and of course, there's a lot of pressure riding on these matches and people, are also coming after your spot. So, but for me, I think the biggest thing that I found in, my changes, I've found a sort of inner confidence within myself that I know that if I do certain things right within the week, if I prep well and do all of the, the stuff within the week, I can go and enjoy the match. And I think I'm clear with, Greg is brilliant and Finn as well. Playing with Finn is fantastic because, he takes the pressure away from some of these matches. The players around you that we have within the team at Scotland is amazing. You feel relaxed in the environment to be yourself. You feel relaxed on the pitch that if you want to try something, you can try something. And if it doesn't work, somebody will graft their ass off to cover for you. So, and I think, that sort of, that environment's fantastic to be in as a player because you feel comfortable and you feel like you can be your best. And that's probably brought the best out of me in these games. And that's why, I said sometimes you don't feel the pressure because you know that the people around you will help you and look after you. And if it's not going well for you in for 5 minutes, they'll pick up the slack. And if it's not going well for them, you'll do the same. And that's just a great environment to be in. And yeah, I love every minute of it.
Ben, thanks so much for your time and good luck this weekend and for the rest of Six Nations too.
No worries. Thank you.
Okay, the rest of the weekend's games. Over in Dublin, we've got Ireland taking on Wales. Let's start with that. That feels fun. Ireland looking fairly imperious over the first couple of weeks. Very impressive, scoring lots of points. Everything seems to have pushed on a bit from the Rugby World Cup. And Johnny Sexton isn't being missed as much as we thought he was. We noted last week how a few kind of key players weren't involved against Italy. I think it was Peter Amani and Bundiaki, and the sense is that they'll be back, Charles, I think you said last time.
Yeah, I think that was certainly the vibe that we got from Andy Farrell. But then Hugo Keenan is out. That they're looking at starting Kieran Frawley at 15?
Frawley, super versatile player, super sure, big favourite of Andy Farrell. And Crowley has looked awesome. I've seen some sort of suggestions from Irish media that are we over blowing this too much? Is this guy really as good as we're saying it? Are we wearing of overhyping him? I think he's looked fantastic. If you take out that, I think even if you think about the mistakes he made early on in Marseille, how he came back from that and then just ran the game really nicely, and showed how ruthless Ireland can be against Italy. I know he missed a few kicks off the tee and there was that flat period in the second half, but he's looked brilliant. And actually, that's kind of a testament to not only just how good a promising a talent he is, but also the system around him and how smooth and how well functioning that looks.
Just reading on Keenan, he's not out officially as of Paul Connell a few days ago. He's a concern, but he's not out. And actually, Paul O'Connell said it was good because it's given them more chance to have a look at other people at fullback just while he hasn't been able to train, just to improve their depth. From a Welsh perspective, can you see anything from Twickenham which makes you suggest that Wales will have enough to go there and potentially threaten Ireland? Charlie, maybe.
I can't. No, we spoke about it last week, didn't we? I thought it was really resilient performance at Twickenham, but if you think about who they're playing, that England just didn't maybe have the tools and the cohesion to put them away early on, and then that changes the kind of the outlook on the game, and they just and even against the kind of stuttering England, it wasn't an air of inevitability about England's comeback, but England sort of gradually got hold of the game, didn't they, there in that second half. And I think Ireland just have aren't going to be in too much danger of being drawn into anything remotely resembling that sort of dogfight. I can see it being a tricky afternoon, but Wales love that fixture, don't they? And they'll love being super underdogs.
I was going to say, would it certainly be one of Warren Gatland's greatest ever wins with Wales. Would it be the best in terms of a solo one match standout?
I think it's in the conversation just because looking at when Wales last won in Dublin outside in the Six Nations, not including a World Cup warm-up in 2015. They haven't actually won in Dublin since 2012, which I think emphasises how long it's been since they've gone there in the Championship and managed to deliver on that front.
Was that a Rhys Priestland special? I seem to remember him absolutely nailing Ireland.
You're testing my memory, but if I quickly check, because it was the opening weekend of that Six Nations, you had a Jonathan Davies brace and a late George North try to win it.
Was Priestland at 10? I can't remember.
He was indeed.
Yes.
Good memory. I should have said that he wasn't, just to see you crumble in your chair
out.
And
stormed out the studio.
Be outraged at how things have gone. I'm really. I think might it be this? This sounds like I'm trying to do Ireland down a bit, and I promise I'm not. Might it actually be good for the Championship for Wales to give Ireland a bit of a wobble, like they've done to Scotland in Cardiff with that comeback, and certainly like they did at Twickenham with the way that how tight that game was. Actually, do we kind of need, as much as I love watching Ireland, kind of on this like mini procession to the title, and Charlie, I know you do as well, are you kind of excited to see would a Welsh bit of pressure just liven things up a little bit?
I'm just really wary of sounding righteous here and just saying for the good of this tournament we need Ireland to lose or to struggle. It would be great, sure, it'd be great, because we've then last week though we didn't have, there was sort of fairly, I think it's fair to say, a reasonably flat round two, wasn't it? And it's looking like Murrayfield will be fairly close with the other two, potential to be sort of blowouts again. What I would say, though, also is that all of these discussions of a potential procession to the title is sort of a fair reflection of how good Ireland are and how well they've come on, how much depth they've got, how in tune they are with the game plan that they've implemented, how well Andy Farrell has overseen that setup. So another kind of dominant victory for them, which is what we're expecting, would only hammer that home.
Yeah, a shameless plug here. I went to see Sir Gareth Edwards last week, who told me a great story about how he played with David Jenkins' grandfather when Gareth Edwards was at schoolboy level. Yeah. And actually, David Jenkins' family live in the next village to where Gareth Edwards is. And they're both the two youngest captains in Wales history. Gareth Edwards at 20. David Jenkins at 21. So shameless plug, that's on the website. Charles, anything to add for this game?
No, not really. I think that, as I said, I think that it would be one of Warren Gatland's and Wales' greatest ever victories if they went there and won. But the tournament does need a shake-up. It has become a bit stale. I wouldn't quite go as far as to say boring, but I think that it has a bit stale. It seems like a bit of a foregone conclusion at the minute, and you do sort of hope, not even for the good of the tournament, just for entertainment's sake, that there's just a bit of a twist in the tail. It doesn't have to necessarily be Ireland, but, you know, just an upset somewhere now, and that, you know, all the results aren't just a complete foregone conclusion might be nice. Ireland are head and shoulders above the other five by the look of things of what we've seen thus far, so they would be deserved Grand Slammers and Championship winners, but could we just have a bit of a twist?
I mean, getting Gary Ringrose back as well, just when you thought, you know, things couldn't get much better for them.
Now and Henshaw's been awesome.
Henshaw's been brilliant. He has been really brilliant. So lots of strength in depth. The other game is going to be France against Italy on Sunday in Lille. Charles, you're going to be there.
I will be. I don't know what result I want more. I don't know if I want an Italian victory or France commanding win, I'm sort of torn.
Because of
Natalie Imbruglia.
Because of all that. Oh, that's a good recovery.
Yeah.
Well done. Because of the chaos at the end of Murrayfield the other week, I don't think I got a chance to talk enough about how just kind of catty Fabien Gauthier was, or sort of playful with the French press and with the media. Like, he spoke about the Timo thing, and he was sarcastically being like, oh, yeah, it's great to like track it out over 4 minutes and to build up all the tension. And then also when he was asked in French about the kind of like vibe around the team and the narrative about the team underperforming, he was like, yeah, like, keep writing it, it's great, like, we love it.
The chippiness, I don't mind it when it comes from a sort of position of real strength. And I know,
like Andy Farrell.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That'd be sort of more valid chippiness, you'd say. And okay. I'm not saying, you know, France is still, you know, still one from two, but they have just looked so unconvincing, I think, that maybe that looks like, maybe it's more of a front.
Yeah, I mean, I know I've also got a bit of a tight head issue, and Gaultier and his unconventional wisdom, as he has done, has called up a tight head from the second division who plays for Agen. He plays in the Pro des Deux. Not called up Georges-Henri Colombe, who is at La Rochelle, that behemoth at La Rochelle, who he's called up before, formerly of Racing. So he's not been called up because Thomas Laclayat is injured and he's their third choice. So there's if either Antonio or Aldeguerri are not fit for Sunday, at the minute they both are, but if they're not fit, then there could be a second division French tight head.
That's got great, like, Marc Livremont, Jacques Brunel, shambles definitely. Vibes, doesn't it? It's quite exciting.
Boxis is going to be on the bench at tight head.
To wrap up, I'm going to quickly go around to the three of you, predict the three games, who wins. Charles, starting with you. Just bang, 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 three words.
Ireland, England, Italy.
Wow. I'm checking in with the bookmakers on that. Charlie?
Ireland by 22, Scotland by 2, France by 12.
Scotland by 2 is lovely. Yeah, it's Ireland, Scotland, France. Margins.
Ireland, Scotland, France.
I'm
actually going to revert. I'm going to go France on the Sunday.
No, you can't cop
yeah,
out.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I am copping out. I'm sticking with England. I think England could go there and do the business, but I think this is a golden opportunity for Italy, but they haven't been good enough in the first two weekends. I think that was my heart over my head saying that Italy might win, but so I think I'm going to go with France.
Just desperate for a memorable day in Lille.
Yeah, could you give me something to remember Lille, please?
Let's do some questions. Okay, time for some of your questions. Thank you ever so much for sending them in, as always. Quickly wanted to flag, actually, England AV Portugal on Sunday, which should be quite... Now, listen, it should be interesting from an England perspective. From a Portugal perspective, I feel like we need to warn everybody, you're not getting your fun Portugal from the World Cup because of release issues.
They'll still be fun, but not World Cup fun.
Not maybe as fun.
Yeah. They'll play the same way, just not as well.
The intent... Well, I mean, wow.
Wouldn't even want to make that promise.
I'm glad you're not in charge of the marketing for Sunday. From an England A perspective, anybody who kind of leaps out who you'd like to see do well? I find it very odd that Tom Pearson's involved in England A games because I'd like to see more of him with the senior side. But this is a good shop window.
It is. There's some players like him who are... He's only got one cap, and that was in one of the worst... Well, the first World Cup warm-up game, which was...
Talk about games you've forgotten about.
Fairly grim.
And we were there.
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah. So you would, you're right. It's a really big shop window for him. I was on the Zooms with Sam Vesti and Conor O'Shea last week, and there's just a lot of carrying power, a lot of pace. Sam Vesti's promised to keep it very simple as far as the game plan that he wants to implement, and that's going to be a lot of fun. And a few intriguing props in there, Josh Yusefa-Scott, tight head.
He's huge, by the way.
Big lad.
Saw him at Gloucester on Saturday. He's absolutely massive.
They've sort of plugged this as a team where there's been a lot of England age grade players that they're giving a kind of a vehicle into senior stuff. But he hasn't, obviously, he's born in New Zealand, hasn't played for England age grade, and it's quite obvious that they fancy fast tracking a big lad at tight head. So that's going to be interesting.
Ollie Slightholm for me.
Yeah, good shout.
Ollie Slightholm on the wing.
Or notably, Oliver, as he's listed.
Is he listed as an Oliver? Apologies.
Which threw me as
apologies
well.
Apologies to the Slightholm family. Oliver Slightholm. I think that he could be a bit like you with Pearson, Colsey. I think that he could be doing a job for the senior team with England on the wing. I think there is going to be places up for grabs there, and I think everything that I've seen from him this season with Northampton, but not just this season. I know he's been injured. He was injured last season for quite a large stretch, but before that, he always looked like somebody who was to the manor born at Premiership level and really stood out, really well-rounded game, but also lightning quick. And I'd like to see him go really well and really push Freeman and Daly in the senior squad. Also, Ollie Hartley, who's probably not quite at the same career progression, sort of career, the same point in his career as Ollie Slighthome, but another Ollie Hartley, who's been looked really good for Saracens at 12. When he's played, when Nick Tompkins hasn't been available or when they've rotated, he's looked really, really good for Saracens at 12. And another chip to throw into the England midfield conversation.
Oh, that's good, because I was worried we were running out of options. Russ Tuima, I just wanted to mention as well, who had a lovely little break and offload.
Oh,
on Saturday. He's fun.
Yeah. He's quite rare. Well, he's a big tight head lock. He went through England age groups as an eight and has been moved to tight head lock. Put on a bit of Terry. Looks fun, yeah. As you say, real fun.
Sorry, a bit of Terry
Tate.
Fantastic, very good. Into the questions. Random Hero asks: does the Six Nations need 2 rest weeks? Lots of casual fans I know moan about losing interest in dragging it out for such a long period of time. And Charlie, the answer is:
well, by 2026, they are losing rest week. But I think it makes sense for a few reasons. It's going to be tough on those players. It's going to be more of an arduous kind of treadmill, that tournament. However, there's a few things here. One, I think that is a valid point as far as people losing interest, losing those the strands of narrative that go on throughout a tournament and how a tournament builds, especially when you get a bit of a flat round, as we did, as we're talking about round two. The other thing is, certainly when the Premiership is concerned with 10 games and you're losing that, a lot of teams having to kind of organise these friendlies to get a bit of revenue in. The interesting thing will be whether the Six Nations moves, how the Premiership and other domestic competitions move around the Six Nations.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, do we know whether they're chopping a weekend off the end of the Six Nations, or is it starting a weekend
later? Well, I'm talking about moving the whole Six Nations maybe later and then fitting in, so it's sort of like an NFL style kind of time frame for an English domestic season, maybe. We'll see.
Well, I was going to ask, which rest week are you chopping? So are you going to play 3 games and then have a rest, or are you going to play 2 and then do 3 on the trot?
I mean, I don't know what they are going to do, but I would do that. I would play 3.
Play 3, and that makes more sense.
Because then you've got a real good scope of how the final 2 games are sort of shaping up as the denouement of the tournament, and you know what's going to, what your storylines are. Whereas 2 games in to then have a break, I mean, I know they do that now, but then there's the other break as well. 2 games in to have a break and then play 3, there's not as much of a hook.
Yeah, yeah. Next question from Taps, which always makes me think Ben Tapawai for some reason.
That is his nickname, isn't it?
Yeah. Do you think England look fitter this year? I mean, you two have seen more England in the flesh than I have, so I'll defer to one of you.
I think the big problem last year was that sort of asking Mark McCall whether his players were fit was quite interesting. He's going, look, they are fit. They're just not in tune with the game plan that England are playing, so they don't look fit. And the Scotland game last year was a great example, because England did play some nice stuff, but then sort of the last quarter just looked really leggy, because they weren't used to that intensity sort of collectively. That was Alid Walters' big kind of brief when he came in as head of conditioning. And I think they have looked, they've looked more assured in those second halves, haven't they? Because there's that just additional cohesion collectively with the game plan they're playing and what that demands.
They definitely do look fitter, I would say. Are they fit enough? Who knows? Well, I mean, we'll probably find out over the next 3 weeks, but certainly the signs are good. They had a really strong second half against Italy and a strong second half against Wales. And, that the proof's in the pudding, and they've not been eating very much pudding, clearly, if they're fitter. But the proof is in the pudding, and I would say yes. As a kickoff, yes, they do look fitter. And they should look fitter, because they've brought in the best, who's widely regarded as one of the best S&C coaches in world rugby. and he had a big run up with them last year ahead of the World Cup. They've had the World Cup, and so they should look fitter, and I think they do.
Yeah, I was thinking Walters and Felix Jones. You're basically on the Springbok fitness plan, and yeah, I think they look sharper. Mm. Question from Elliot, which is, I like this question a lot. If all three of you were a player, which team in the Six Nations would you want to play for? I mean, Charles, this is so smackingly obvious that I'm going to come to you first.
Yeah, I'm going to go France, I'm afraid.
Okay. And why could that be?
I just think my talents on the rugby field would suit them quite well.
They're lacking a tight head, aren't they? Do you reckon, could you do a job?
Too tall. Although Willie Atolio is very tall, but he's also built like a brick outhouse. So, I mean, if they carry on having some injuries, then I'll be checking my passport and my lineage at the tight end, yeah.
Right, so, Charlie?
You've already checked your passport. Yeah,
yeah, I have already done that, yeah.
I've got two answers here. Wales for ancestry reasons, but less kind of tangibly. France, just cool kits, that sort of thing. That's what I was thinking.
I hadn't thought about basing my answer on the kit.
And Anthem as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Galtier's head coach, though.
Anthem's good.
Yeah. Well, bantering when you've been playing badly.
Galtier's head coach. I might have to say Ireland, just a bit like you, for ancestry reasons. And also, it seems quite fun at the moment. Also, it seems like the most fun style of play. They're having a great time. Question from Henry, who says, just on the Newcastle Falcons and Saudi Arabia links, after a photo popped up on social media on Sunday of various Newcastle dignitaries in Saudi Arabia with a framed shirt. I mean, could be a remarkable coincidence, but as I now refer to our rugby Saudi Arabia correspondent Charles Richardson,
Riyadh reporter,
tell us more.
Well, these pictures surfaced. They were sort of thrust into the public eye last night by the Rugby and Sideline Twitter account of Newcastle owner Seymour Kurdi out in Saudi Arabia with what looked like some Saudi dignitaries. It was difficult to sort of fully glean a total picture from just some pictures that had appeared on Instagram that were deleted by Newcastle's rugby chairman Matt Thompson, but it seems as though the story that we reported a few weeks ago is gaining a little bit of traction, and Newcastle are in the market for some Saudi investment. Now, with regard to your question, Henry, would a Falcons and Saudi Arabia union be worse than Falcons going bust? I would say that is a minefield. And when we did this story originally, the reaction, our story originally was that four Premiership clubs were in early preliminary discussions about Saudi funds, and the reaction then was completely polarised to two ends of the spectrum, between fans who were saying, you know, the Premiership has had financial issues, it can't bite the hand that feeds, beggars can't be choosers, all that sort of thing. And then the other end of the scale was people basically saying, if my club takes Saudi investment, then I would rather they were relegated to the Championship than take Saudi investment. So in terms of which is worse, I mean, I think Falcons going bust would be worse on the face of it. Of those two options, of those two,
I feel it's disastrous for the national game
and rugby in the north of England. You know, they're the most northern club. They're the only real sort of northern club, because I know Sale are there, but Manchester is nowhere near as far north as Newcastle. And you know, Newcastle is the local club to Yorkshire, which is a real rugby hotbed. In terms of Premiership, the local Premiership club to Yorkshire, which is a real rugby hotbed, and I think it would be, you know, a real dark day were Newcastle to go bust, I think.
Yeah, agreed. And our final question from Carrick, just about the under-18 finals day on Sunday, just asking if anybody kind of leapt out. Charlie?
So not yet, because I haven't watched all of it back, but you can. It was streamed on YouTube, so you can dive back in. It looks phenomenal. Bath won the final.
I was going to say congratulations to Bath. Yeah.
34-33 in the last minute. Certainly worth catching up on some highlights. One tiny bit I did see was I saw Exeter go from their own shadow of their own post with a kick pass across to a far touch line, all the way up that left touch line, came back to the right, and I think they won a penalty and then went to the corner and moored over for a try against Sale. But yeah, so if that was anything to go by, the whole day was brilliant, and by all means catch up on that, because there's nothing sort of more rewarding as a club supporter than following through prospects the whole way from when they're just emerging via the academy through to the first team. So yeah, make sure to tune into that.
Absolutely. Right, that's it for this week. Thank you both. Where are you going to be this weekend? Charles, where are you going to be? Remind us.
Lille for the big one, France, Italy.
Excellent. Charlie?
Knocking around Pennyhill Park again, and then up to Edinburgh Friday morning. Might catch the under-20s on the Friday night, and then the main event.
Quick quiz question. Do either of you two know the equivalent of the Calcutta Cup that France and Italy play for?
Is it the Garibaldi?
It is, yeah. Is it the Giuseppe Garibaldi trophy, or have I made that up? But it is Garibaldi, definitely.
I know Garibaldi's involved. I can't remember. Yeah, I assume it's Giuseppe. I'll be in Dublin from Friday until...
For the centenary quiche. Is that Ireland, Scotland?
That's Ireland, Scotland. Yeah. What's Ireland, Wales?
Centenary quiche is what I'll be eating in Lille on Sunday.
That's terrible. Looking forward to Ireland, Wales. Please keep up with all of our coverage. There's absolutely loads on the website. Columns from Brian Moore, Will Greenwood and the rest. And thank you to Ben White as well for his time for this week's episode, as well as to Charlie and Charles once more. Thank you for downloading the podcast. As I said, loads of coverage building up to the weekend. Please keep following us for all the stories, all the team news and all the match previews, and we'll be back to review it all next week. For now, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.